his decision. So, but we are not sure if there was any political interference at the highest possible level.
And finally, Dr. Nicoletas, the effect on the indigenous population of Brazil.
Well, that's a tragedy inside of tragedy. We start reporting on this in our committee back in May of last year, saying that the numbers were already above the national average of infected people, and still nothing happened. The number of deaths were above the national average, and the government didn't take any measure or any attitude. So we reported this nationally and internationally for close to 10 months. And
we have 5 seconds.
Oh, and the numbers, you know, keep growing. So it's a tragedy inside of a tragedy.
Dr. Miguel Nicoletas, professor of neurobiology at Duke University, former coordinator of the largest scientific COVID-19 task force in Brazil, has been in Brazil for the last year, speaking to us from Sao Paulo. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a senior news producer to join our team here in New York City. Check it out at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm. All you need is love.
Why do you love KBOO? Tell us what you most love about KBOO Community Radio, and we will use it on air during our next membership drive. Record a one-minute testimonial using the KBOO mobile app, or use a voice recording app on your phone and email it to info@kboo.org. That's info@kboo.org. Thank you.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up in this spring membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, state lawmakers approve making it easier to convert hotels and motels into housing for those who need it. An ambitious new plan targets COVID and the climate crisis while promising to rebuild America. And how older people of color are not getting the health care they need, and what families and communities need to do to fix that. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 1st, 2021. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Annette Newell. Thank you so much for joining us. Oregon lawmakers approved a bill Wednesday that would accelerate the ability to convert hotels and motels into housing for people who are experiencing homelessness. Representative Pam Marsh, a Democrat from Ashland, is sponsoring House Bill 3261. The Ashland region is where 2,500 homes were destroyed in Oregon's deadly 2020 wildfire season. The House voted 41-12, sending the bill to the Senate. If it passes there, the bill will allow empty hotels and motels to repurpose their lodgings as temporary or affordable long-term housing to those who lost their homes from last year's wildfires or other causes. The measure could overturn zoning laws that prohibit the repurposing, provided the buildings fall within the city's urban growth boundary. Applicable locations must have access to transportation and be outside of floodplains or other hazardous areas. Local governments could still apply restrictions, including occupancy limits and site and design standards. Those opposed to this measure say it highlights a bigger problem with unworkable land use laws. House Republican leader Christine Drazen from Canby voted against it, calling for an overhaul of state land use laws instead. Other similar housing efforts are underway in Oregon, including House Bill 2006, which allows the waiving of local zoning, planning, and design regulations by local government, and Project Turnkey, in which the state has set aside $65 million to buy and convert motels into temporary shelters and housing. Currently, Oregon has an estimated 14,000 people who are experiencing houselessness. A new book outlines the organizations and beliefs of domestic terrorists in the United States. The book is called Homegrown Hate: Why White Nationalists and Militant Islamists Are Waging War Against the United States. It asks why these groups perpetrate acts of terror against their own country. KABU's Isabel Charlet interviewed author and holistic justice activist Sara Kamali.
Sara, you lay out a number of similarities and differences between white nationalists and militant Islamists in your book. Could you briefly kind of lay out some key similarities and differences between the two groups?
That's an excellent place to start. The key similarities would be a mutual sense of victimhood, as well as mutual grievances due to the feeling of being persecuted by, quote unquote, the other.
Under the Trump administration, the political landscape has been largely in support of white nationalism and has kind of bolstered the white nationalism movement. And you also say that at the same time, under the Trump administration, the militant Islamist movement received some bolstering as well. Could you explain how that works?
That's a very nuanced point, and I think that may be of interest to many people because of the Muslim ban, which was one of the first policies that Donald Trump enacted when he became president. That essentially reified and buttressed the sense of grievance that militant Islamists in particular have towards American foreign policy. With regard to the white nationalist grievance, when President Trump came into office, was essentially the word that used, bolstered. And that's very much the case because President Trump didn't necessarily start or the white nationalist ideology that's been in the United States and in many countries around the world for decades, if not centuries. But he very much harnessed the sense of grievance. And specifically, that has to do with the perception that people of color are taking over, not only in terms of just sheer numbers, but also taking over job opportunities and threatening the very cultural identity of white people in the United States.
You conducted in-depth personal interviews with a number of key figures, both American white nationalists and American militant Islamists. And you employed some unconventional means of interviewing. You say, you quote, "enter into my subjects' worldviews completely and fully to comprehend their rationales for violence according to their logic, not what I thought they were or may have been." Why use such a personal method of interviewing? And what was that like for you, especially as a Muslim American woman?
So I could write a whole other book just on those two issues. The introductory chapter, I think you're taking that quote from, has empathy in the title. And the reason that I discuss the employment of empathy so specifically is because that's essentially what the world needs. And I'm not talking about empathy in terms of condoning or supporting the violence or the planned violence. I'm talking about empathy in terms of actually seeking to understand how another person rationalizes his or her use of violence and the planning and the carrying out of it. It was really interesting for me because there were a lot of expectations on the part of the interviewees that were made clear to me either in terms of communicating and setting up interviews and also during the course of the conversations that I would have. So militant Islamists very much would think that I would sympathize or condone their behaviors and their worldviews, whereas I received a lot of pushback from many white nationalists of all ages because they were very reticent to talk to me and specifically cited my surname as a reason why many of them didn't want to talk to me.
You end your book by calling for holistic justice. Could you explain what that means?
Holistic justice is an approach to counterterrorism in order to ensure effective national security based on the recognition that white nationalism is more complex than simply skin color oppression or racism. So what holistic justice is calling for is a move from anti-racism to anti-oppression. to take into account that we need to see that the survivors and the victims and survivors of white nationalists and militant Islamists as a whole, and also that there needs to be a lot more solidarity amongst different groups of people of color. And the onus also needs to be placed on white communities who would call themselves liberals and supporters of people of color in order to amplify and address the hate that's targeted towards their fellow Americans.
That was Sara Kamali, author of Homegrown Hate, Why White Nationalists and Militant Islamists Are Waging War Against the United States. I'm Isabel Charlet for KBOO News.
A gunman killed four people Wednesday evening in a California business complex. Police say the victims had personal and professional ties to the suspect in Orange County. A 9-year-old boy, two women, and one man are dead, with a fifth woman injured and in critical but stable condition at a hospital. Victims from the shooting are remaining unidentified until police notify their families. Police have ID'd a suspect, 44-year-old Aminadab Gonzalez, who is in critical condition. Orange County police say it appears Gonzalez knew the victims, and this was not a random act of violence. The gunshots broke out at a business complex called Unified Homes. Police say the suspect locked the entry gates from the inside using a bicycle cable-type lock. Investigators found a semi-automatic handgun and a backpack with ammo, pepper spray, and handcuffs, which they believe belonged to the suspect. Orange County's district attorney says the suspect is eligible for the death penalty because multiple victims are involved. Currently, California has a moratorium in effect for its death penalty under orders signed by Governor Gavin Newsom in 2019. Wednesday's massacre is at least the 20th mass shooting across the nation since the Atlanta attacks killed 8 people 2 weeks ago. It's day 4 of the murder trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. Chauvin's on trial for the murder of George Floyd in May of 2020. Chauvin knelt on Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes until he died. A paramedic and Floyd's girlfriend took the stand today. Courtney Ross dated Floyd for 3 years up until his death. She spoke tearfully about their shared struggle with opioid addiction. This is an attempt by the prosecution to get out in front of the defense's claim that Floyd died because of drug use, not Chauvin. Ross detailed how she and Floyd met and their first kiss. Georgia Fort from the Racial Reckoning Project has more from Minneapolis.
Intensity continues to build in the courtroom following yet another day of emotional testimony.
Wait a minute.
A 61-year-old man who witnessed the death of George Floyd, Charles McMillan, broke down on the stand when the prosecution replayed footage of the moments leading up to Floyd's death. In the footage, you can hear McMillan pleading with Floyd.
You can't win. I'm not trying to win. I'm not trying to win. I'll get on the ground, anything.
I'll get in the car.
He know it too, Mr. Officer. Y'all hear me?
Following McMillan's testimony, attorneys for the state played multiple recordings, including the body camera footage of all officers involved and surveillance from inside of Cup Foods. The surveillance footage shows George Floyd in the store interacting with multiple people, even laughing with another customer at one point. A 19-year-old cashier testified Wednesday afternoon about the moment he realized George Floyd gave him a counterfeit $20 bill.
When I saw the bill, I noticed that it had a blue pigment to it, kind of how a $100 bill will have, and I found that odd, so I assumed that it was fake.
The cashier said he now feels guilt for the choices he made that evening. Outside of the courtroom, the community continues to protest, demanding justice for George Floyd. Protesters once again wrote names of those killed by police on locks and hung them on the fence surrounding the government center. Previous locks were cut off by the National Guard. For the Racial Reckoning Project, I'm Georgia Fort.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a special rebroadcast of our report on foster care during the pandemic, followed by Noise Filter, debunking COVID-19. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. At 7, Hard Knock Radio. Then at 8, Ear to the Streets of Portland. Tonight's weather, cloudy early with some clearing expected later in the evening, a low down to 38. Tomorrow's weather, partly cloudy skies in the morning, will continue into cloudy skies by the afternoon, a high of 62. As for the weekend, Saturday it's going to get up to 66 but fall back down to the 50s for highs on Sunday. Today in history, on this date in 1700, English pranksters began popularizing the annual tradition of April Fool's Day by playing practical jokes on each other. The quote of the day is from Will Rogers, who said, "Everything is funny, as long as it's happening to somebody else." With more and more people fully vaccinated, hopefully people can start planning for what happens once the pandemic is under control. COVID has exposed that being well requires many needs being met. Joining us now is Dr. Sarita Mohanty, the president and CEO of the SCAN Foundation, which is an independent public charity devoted to transforming care for older adults. Welcome, Dr. Mohanty.
Thank you.
We know the number of older adults is rapidly increasing in America, and you're saying that a roadmap for system-wide changes in health services is needed. What would that roadmap look like?
Yes, this master plan for aging is truly a roadmap for system-wide changes and how we can make sure services are coordinated, delivered, and financed effectively to meet the needs of our older adults. And this is so critically important because in your state, Oregon, 18% of the population is 65 plus and growing. And so we all want a less fragmented, less confusing, and more connected network. And so the master plan wants to cater to the person-centered care, the individualized needs of older adults.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the trends you're seeing in the Pacific Northwest? You just mentioned a bit about Oregon, and we'd like to know about Washington as well. Are we coping with these trends and planning for them effectively?
I think there are some real opportunities in Oregon and in Washington. You know, in Washington state, the number of older adults, 65 and older, is 16% of the total population. I think that was 29 statistics. And I think even if you look at Jefferson County, that percentage is actually more than double. It's like 38% and growing. So, you know, there are some real opportunities to really look at how to incorporate more person-centered home and community-based services and support for individuals, especially in the rural areas. If you think about rural needs, telehealth, telemedicine, and making sure there's no inequities in how people access technology is really important.
Mm-hmm. You know, you're talking about 16 to 18% or even 30%. Are we expecting those numbers to grow, and how fast and soon could we see those numbers grow as a percentage of the population?
Yeah, as baby boomers age, there are more older adults than ever. I think the AARP estimates that by 2034, the U.S. will, for the first time ever, be a country that is comprised of more older adults than even children. And the U.S. Census Bureau is projecting that there will be 77 million people age 65 and over, and many of those will struggle with chronic disease.
Mm-hmm. What has this past year of COVID and the pandemic exposed about people getting care? And doing so at home instead of leaving their communities?
Absolutely. We've seen that the pandemic has had a major and, I would say, protracted impact on our communities. We've seen a social pandemic, in fact, of anxiety, economic insecurity, food insecurity, housing instability, social isolation. And it's a striking reminder that older adults are valued members of society who deserve to age with dignity and independence. And so we recognize that there is a stronger need for both community and government support, like helping older adults with house cleaning, shopping, getting groceries, cooking, retrofitting homes so that we can prevent falls, how we can actually support telehealth capabilities more effectively and make sure there's a proper technology, and then home-based care medical models and actually non-medical models to support older adults in their home.
Mm-hmm. You also are pointing to racial and ethnic disparities exposed by the pandemic. You're calling it a stark digital divide. What is that, and what needs to be done to fix that?
Yeah, it's a heightened awareness that not everyone, when we try to say, okay, well, we're going to have you connect to medical care or other social services using technology, recognizing that not everybody has access to that technology, and what can we do to mitigate that digital divide? So asking them those important questions and really actually making sure they have the support to enable that technology, have that enabling technology in their home, and also work with policymakers to reinforce the importance that everyone should have proper technology and supports in their home and the community.
When you talk about a master plan for aging, what are the components of that to make it a success?
The master plan is really important because it really speaks to coordinate, deliver, and finance services effectively and seamlessly to meet the needs of older adults. The really important piece of this is making sure that there's outlined clear goals and strategies to execute on. So it's not just a plan. And one example is in California, where a master plan for aging has been introduced that has 5 bold goals and 23 strategies, and making sure that there is a data dashboard that looks at the progress of the master plan as it goes forward, whether it's how it's being budgeted, how it's going, working through legislation, and also how it's being introduced into the community. So it's really about following a plan through its execution steps.
Mm-hmm. Now, in that case and others, do you see the solutions as coming from government or independent charities or the business community or a combination?
It's certainly a combination. It's so important that this is multifaceted, multi-stakeholder. You mentioned government, you know, you think about it at state level, but also local communities, payers, providers, community organizations, philanthropic. It is because there right now care has been, and we've unmasked this, has been so fragmented, we have to bring everybody together and make sure, and advocacy organizations as well, to ensure the success of the master plan for aging.
Mm-hmm. As a doctor, what advice would you give to people about successful aging, especially aging in your own home in successfully?
Yeah, I think it's really important as a physician, and I've seen this, you know, in my own practice, that people have had a lot of time to think about what matters to them, especially during the pandemic. And it's really ensuring that they communicate that information to their provider, that they need to engage their family members in the care, that support network is important, that they're having trouble accessing technology and they need some support, or maybe they need financial assistance or financial counseling, who to turn to. So my advice would be to really work with your systems that you're connected with and communicate that to them. And similarly, we in the healthcare sector have an obligation to also ask these questions and make sure we connect older adults to the proper services. So it is, and we got to find ways to streamline that communication.
And what advice would you give to the younger generations about helping their aging loved ones have a better plan for aging?
I think it is really critical that they work, and same thing, asking about the wants, the needs, the preferences of the person they're helping in their home. Older adults want to live with dignity and respect and independence. And so making sure that they find ways to help them be motivated and be able to do the things that they want to do, or identifying new opportunities that can make them happy, new types of skills, new types of, you know, we saw grandmas on Zoom, and that's not a new thing anymore. So how do we help our older adults, our loved ones, get access to those type of supports and services?
Okay. Is there anything else that I haven't asked you about that you'd like to mention?
The main thing for us is that I would reinforce that the policymakers really saw an opportunity to think about changing some rules to make it easier for clinicians to treat people, older adults, remotely, and gets back to ensuring that individuals can have the services they need in their homes, in their community. I would reinforce that we should look at those COVID era policies and really try to support and promote those type of policies moving forward. So that would be one of my closing thoughts, is that we really do want to ensure that we sustain some of the policies that were introduced.
All right. Thank you so much, Sarita, for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for the time.
President Biden unveiled a new infrastructure plan that would cost $2 trillion. The plan would address the country's failing infrastructure, increase broadband internet, and mitigate climate change. With more in the story, here's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
It's a once-in-a-generation investment in America, unlike anything we've seen or done since we built the interstate highway system and the space race decades ago. It's the largest American jobs investment since World War II.
President Joe Biden shared the first part of his $2 trillion infrastructure proposal, the American Jobs Plan, Wednesday in Pittsburgh, which would fix roads and bridges, rail service, airports, and create millions of jobs. Biden said the U.S. ranks 13th in the world in infrastructure, with highways and public transit facilities in disrepair, while foreign competitors race ahead. Clean transportation technology, including charging stations for electric vehicles, is a key focus.
You and your family could travel coast to coast without a single tank of gas on board a high-speed train. We can connect high-speed, affordable, reliable internet wherever you live.
It won't be easy to pass the huge bill, which also includes funding for home care services, manufacturing, housing, broadband, and schools, especially on the heels of the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan, which had no GOP support.
I spoke to the Republican leader about the plan. Everybody's for doing something on infrastructure. Why haven't we done it? Well, no one wants to pay for it.
The corporate tax rate would rise from 21 to 28% for 15 years to pay for the plan, not as high as the rate during the Obama administration. The New York Times writes business groups and large corporations mostly reacted negatively to the news. House Democrats hope to pass the bill by July 4th. Biden said the second part of his infrastructure plan, the American Family Plan, is coming within weeks and is expected to include paid family leave, among other policy priorities. Dawn Hucklebridge, director of the Paid Leave for All campaign, points out that when the pandemic began, one of the first things Congress did was pass a temporary paid leave program. She says now Congress needs to go further.
We must include a comprehensive and permanent federal paid leave policy to rebuild the care infrastructure in this country and to have an equitable economic recovery.
Polling shows an overwhelming majority of voters, including 86% of Republicans, say all workers should have access to emergency paid sick, family, and medical leave. The Biden administration let a Trump-era coronavirus ban on some temporary foreign work visas expire. Trump had suspended new visas for skilled tech workers through the H-1B program, students on work study, and seasonal hospitality workers. Under growing pressure, U.S. House candidate Rita Hart of Iowa dropped her challenge against Republican Representative Marionette Miller Meeks in their razor-thin House race, removing a thorny decision for members of the House over whether to overturn election results certified by the state.
The Indian Health Service announced new plans for coronavirus vaccine distribution and home testing. With that story and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with the National Native News, the daily report dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
The Indian Health Service has administered more than 940,000 COVID-19 vaccines since December, with a goal to reach 1 million this week, according to Indian Health Service leaders. Members of the IHS COVID-19 Vaccine Task Force and representatives from the Albuquerque and Navajo areas provided an update on a media call about COVID-19 response in Indian country. Dr. Matthew Clark with the IHS COVID-19 Vaccine Task Force says American Indian and Alaska Native communities are leading the way in vaccinations. Clark says the IHS is now trying a new vaccine distribution system in two regions to improve efficiency, where facilities order what they need instead of getting an allocation. He says the IHS is also starting to provide at-home COVID-19 tests.
To further improve access to testing, we are announcing that the IHS will now begin providing the LUM COVID-19 home test to IHS tribal and urban Indian sites at no cost. This home test is a non-prescription nasal swab suitable for individuals 2 years of age and older with or without symptoms and offers results in about 15 minutes. A smartphone and downloaded application are required for use of this test. Results are automatically sent through the smartphone device to the appropriate health authority.
As tribes across the country look at opening up or easing restrictions, the IHS says it will work with tribes to support their decisions. Dr. Juliana Reese is chief medical officer for the Albuquerque area.
Anything that we can do to support with regard to public health information, support from our staff, we are happy to be there. But I think those are all going to be very local decisions based on their tribal dynamics in the community at risk.
Indian Health Service leaders say the IHS is committed to COVID-19 prevention efforts, detection, treatment, and recovery. Biden's American Rescue Plan includes new funding for IHS to address COVID-19. In Canada, the number of COVID-19 cases in First Nations and Inuit communities have dropped since November to under 1,000, the CBC reports. Federal data showed there were 931 active cases at the end of March, with new infections primarily in the province of Manitoba. There have been more than 24,000 cases in First Nations communities since the start of the pandemic. The rate of cases among First Nations people living on reserve is higher than the general Canadian population, while vaccine distribution continues across First Nation and Inuit communities. The Native Youth Olympics are taking place online this year. The virtual competition will start Monday and run through the end of April. Students grades 7 through 12 will compete in traditional Alaska Native games from their home communities. Athletes will record their performances on video and submit them to judges. The games usually take place in late April in Anchorage. This year's virtual competition is due to COVID-19 health and safety concerns. Cook Inlet Tribal Council has hosted the event for more than 30 years. The games celebrate culture and teach teamwork and leadership values while testing endurance, skill, and balance of the mind and body. The events are based on skills involved with subsistence activities. Medals will be awarded to first through fifth place finishers in each event. The games can be followed online and on social media at NYO Alaska. Grassroots groups, including the Indigenous Environmental Network and Indian Collective, are calling on the Biden administration to close the Dakota Access Pipeline. Demonstrations are taking place in Washington, D.C. to mark the five-year anniversary of when pipeline construction began. Indigenous-led groups are seeking an executive order to shut down the pipeline. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 1st, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Isabel Charlet, and Claire Risciotto. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service, Native Voice One, and the Racial Reckoning Project. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us. All of these KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Over the past year, more than 8,000 foster care children in Oregon have endured constantly adapting to new situations, from where they live to how they learn. This means struggling to learn in front of a computer for hours on end, to now, after a year of online learning, adjusting going back to school while wearing a mask, social distancing, and learning in a classroom. Many foster children already face falling into serious statistics and being one of the less than 5% who will attend college or be one of under 50% who will not graduate high school. And their chances of becoming homeless or incarcerated are significantly higher than their peers. Portland's oldest child welfare organization, Boys and Girls Aid, is working to ensure that the challenges and obstacles of learning during the pandemic do not keep foster children and youth from having all the tools and resources they need to be successful students. Today, I spoke with Boys and Girls Aid, Sue Keller, who is the program director of The Neighborhood, a program that supports foster care youth and their specific needs, such as remote learning. Here is more with my interview with Sue Keller.
What are some things that you want listeners to know about your organization and the foster care system at large right now? What can people do, and what should they know about?
Well, currently our foster care system it's overloaded. The caseloads of our DHS staff are not manageable in a timely manner. And we know this. The whole world knows this. Agencies like Boys and Girls Aid are here to assist with that, to be an alternative to standard foster care. And we partner with DHS, and we find them to be extremely helpful in so many ways. I was thinking about this interview and just thinking about a time over the pandemic when I had a youth who had a COVID exposure and needed to be quarantined. And unfortunately, we did not have the staff or support available to quarantine him for the full length of time. And it was really amazing that DHS was able to step up and provide a kind of a respite placement where that youth could safely go during the quarantine and enjoy his time and not feel penalized by what was going on, but rather it was more of a vacation. They had really put everything in place and worked really well with us to make sure that it was as comfortable for the youth as it possibly could be. And as you know, this is not a comfortable time, right? There's nothing comfortable about constantly jumping from home to home. And so I was just thinking of that example because this youth's DHS caseworker worked with me so quickly and so compassionately to make sure that the placement for this youth was supportive and warm and really helped, you know, my team, who was feeling awful that some of us were sick and not able to provide the care that we needed to be able to provide, and also really support that youth and give him a safe place to stay. So I think it's really important for the community to understand that there are a multitude of agencies beyond DHS that are attempting to do this work and attempting to serve children in need. And there are a multitude of ways that you can get involved, whether it be directly with DHS or with an agency such as ours. And it doesn't have to be necessarily being a foster parent, although I beg of you, if you're available to be a foster parent, you have no idea the amazing impact you will make in the life of a child. But if that is outside the means of what your family can do, there are so many other ways to get involved. And it's as easy as just contacting an agency like Boys and Girls Aid and saying, I want to help. What can I do? And they will just give you a litany of ideas.
Can you tell us what were some of the challenges that all foster children were facing working with organizations before the pandemic, and then how has the pandemic worsened or created new issues?
Well, from the perspective of just a parent who has been a foster parent, I will tell you, you know, that all foster children come in with their own trauma history, and it affects the way that they interact in a school setting. It affects their ability to learn and the support that they need. Virtual, having to switch to distance learning or virtual learning is obviously going to weigh heavily on that. Generally in school, children who have that level of need receive certain supports from paraprofessionals, and that same support is not obviously available in a distance learning setting. So I will say, from the perspective of a foster parent or even just a parent, watching children in general struggle with the transition from in-person learning and being able to have immediate access to their teachers and hands-on learning experiences to something on a screen where they need to sit in place all day is very difficult. From my perspective in my program, which is the neighborhood at Boys and Girls Aid, we serve teens ages 12 to 18 of all genders throughout three different counties. And those teenagers have all been receiving some type of paraprofessional support when they are in school. They also have teams of people assisting them. They have multiple services that they receive in the community. They have flexibility of schedule. They have things like breaks throughout the day so that they can, you know, just kind of chill for a minute, regroup themselves, get ready to, to pay back attention, and to put them in front of a screen from, say, 9:30 to 3:30 Monday through Friday and hope that they are going to just sit there and listen to a teacher lecture with no assistance has really been a sad and disappointing struggle for these youth.
Obviously, most parents and those in your position and those who work with you, I'm sure, just want children to be able to safely go back to school in person. In the meantime, what can help these kids who are in this situation, whether they're foster care children or not, but especially foster care children, who are, like you said, struggling with so many things that they've experienced and are continuing to experience. And learning is just really difficult right now. Learning, like you said, by yourself, without any assistance through a screen.
Yeah, so for the neighborhood program specifically through Boys and Girls Aid, let me just preface by saying what this program does for foster children is, or has been prior to the pandemic, not just providing support or a foster home for the youth to live in, but we also were providing day programming, which meant that if there are appointments that youth needed to get to during the day, our staff was going and getting them and taking them to those appointments. They would come to our program after school each day. We could assist them with homework. We could assist them with life skills training, social interactions, opportunities for peer development. And so every day, at least Monday through Friday, they were having access to assistance even outside of school, right? So building social skills, getting assistance with their academics, all of those things were additional benefits by being in a program such as the neighborhood. Unfortunately, when the pandemic hit, we had to weigh following all the guidelines set out by the CDC, and we had to weigh that against the services that the youth needed, and we had to make a decision to close our day programming facility. And when we closed that facility, these foster parents, who frequently are two working parents, were put in a position where now they had youth who needed 24/7 sight and sound supervision in their home, who needed them to assist with virtual learning throughout the day and after school care and all of the services we provided, while at the same time trying to manage their own jobs and continue to work. And this has proved for some families to really be an impossible feat. And so what happens is the youth most frequently are the ones to lose out because they don't have the same levels of support that they had prior to the pandemic. And unfortunately, for the safety of their families, for the safety of our staff, and obviously for the safety of the clients themselves, we have had to prioritize keeping them in their homes and not exposing them to other youth for the majority of the pandemic. So as a result, the youth have really, really lost out on those supports, both academic and skill building, that they normally would have had access to. And the parents have lost out on that ability to have the time away from the youth in order to manage their own careers. So it's been a real hardship to all parties involved. And of course, you have to consider the safety of our staff in the situation where, when many people are able to work from home, a direct care staff has to be with a child at all times. And regardless of if we can keep those youth home with their foster parents, we still are required by the state to provide a certain amount of behavioral rehabilitation skills on a weekly basis. And so direct care support does still have to occur. So we had a lot of things that we had to factor in when we were considering our best practices and going forward with the pandemic. And at times, as things started to seem like they were lifting a little and we were doing better, we would have discussions on, what could next steps look like? Phase 1, phase 2, phase 3. And the agency was so diligent about making sure that they were planning in advance for this and keeping us posted and up to date. But what we finally found was just the burden of having the kids home all day, every day with no assistance was proving to be such a hardship to their academics and to their family that we were going to have to take some kind of action in order to help the youth succeed and help the parents survive this all in all. So in the case of our program, we went to great lengths to develop a program. We call it pod learning. We use a space out in our Beaverton location, and it's a big office space. And in that giant office space, we can safely host about three youth and two staff at a time with social distancing and obviously following all of the CDC guidelines. And the youth can come to the program 2 days a week and get direct care and assistance all day during their classes. And that gives them also 2 days a week where the parents have free to be able to focus on their jobs. And so that's been helpful. It also allows my staff to be more engaged with what's going on with each youth, who frequently each youth goes to a different high school because they're all from different areas and different counties. So it gives the staff a chance to engage directly with the supports of the school and understand where there might be some lagging skills in academics and where we can better support them, both when they're with us and where we can advise the foster parents for the times when they're back in the home.
Absolutely. And I wanted to ask, you know, how are kids doing? How has that improved their learning? And is there anything that folks who are listening or want to, you know, encourage other folks to either donate their resources or time to help specifically with foster care children and this program?
You know, one of the things at the beginning of the pandemic that I was very grateful for was Portland State University School of Education had entered into talks with us about some of their students coming forward and offering to support youth and do some tutoring with these kids. And unfortunately, because of the pandemic restrictions, it was difficult for us to actually implement that. But I, even just today, it was brought to my attention that as the decision has been made for students to return in the end of March and early April to school, it's just going to be one more transition. And that transition is going to be difficult. So I think having mentors, having donations of resources, having people volunteer to tutor if they have any kind of academic background, all of those things can be really useful. Maybe even just transportation, people that want to be volunteers to transport kids to school because certainly we'll have hybrid models for a while here that are going to affect, you know, the days of the week that kids go versus when their parents work. And it's going to be an interesting thing for us to navigate. And so there's many ways, I think, you know, financially, obviously, donations can contribute directly to us providing the right amount of staffing and transportation and the costs incurred there, the supplies that youth are going to need to be involved on a hybrid basis, the safety supplies around following COVID guidelines and making sure that youth have all the sanitation materials that they need in place. Schools are going to have a very high expectation for opening back up and keeping our kids safe. So I think just looking for all those opportunities to donate and assist, there's a million of them out there. And again, contact our agency if you feel like you're someone that could offer any type of assistance. And we'll get you going.
This is Claire Rosciato with KBOO News in Depth.
Hi,
my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19. So let's get started.
So welcome to COVID Noise Filter. My name is Dr. Mark Alderi, and we are so happy to have guest co-hosting with us, Nurse Julia. Welcome to the show, Nurse Julia.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be coming on board with you guys.
Thank you so much. And now on to the show.
Opioid overdoses higher in 2020 than before the pandemic.
Oh, no, really? All right. How does this go?
Opioid addiction reared its ugly head in 2020. More than 70,000 people died from overdoses, and things seem to be getting worse.
Oh my goodness. Now, according to ABC News, a large study analyzed about 190 million emergency department visits. Now, researchers found out that from mid-April onward, the weekly rates of emergency department visits for drug overdoses increased by up to 45% when compared against the same period in 2019. Now, overall, emergency room visits for opioid overdoses were up 29% from the previous year.
How does this happen? Anything that threatens mental health can leave people more susceptible to the threat of addictions. For some, this may be the fear of contracting COVID-19, the stress of losing a job, or the boredom of being trapped in your home with nothing to do. In December 2020, former CDC Director Dr. Robert Redfield said, "The disruption to daily life due to the COVID-19 pandemic has hit those with substance use disorder hard." Addiction programs designed to help those with substance abuse disorders, like 12-step programs and Alcoholics Anonymous, have been suspended or altered due to social distancing requirements, leaving many in need without support and treatment.
Oh my goodness. So now, while many lives were saved with stay-at-home orders, unfortunately, the cost of forced isolation was too hard for some people. Long after the coronavirus is under control, America will need to find a way to deal with the growing issue of social isolation and mental illness that has been exacerbated by the pandemic. And just to be clear, 70,000 people that died last year from an overdose, that's like a college football stadium full of people, just to give you a mental idea of what 70,000 people, and I thought 70,000 people dying from one thing was remarkable pre-COVID, but in 1 year, we've had 530,000 people die of COVID. And so just the numbers that we're dealing with are just so hard to wrap our brains around. So again, like we say here on COVID Noise Filter, we'll definitively be continuing to follow this story. Hidden homeless crisis. So now America has a huge problem with homelessness in general. Add in the pandemic and the problem is made much worse, as those experiencing homelessness are extremely vulnerable and susceptible to coronavirus infection. Unfortunately, economic issues caused by the pandemic have driven people from their homes and caused them to live in their vehicles.
NBC News calls this hidden homeless crisis. Almost 1 in 500 Americans is homeless, with most of them found on the West Coast and in the Northeast. Homeless advocates say people without permanent housing are chronically undercounted. It's even harder to track the tens of thousands of people living in their vehicles rather than on the streets or in shelters because they must move around so much.
Sarah Rankin is an associate professor of law, and she's the director of the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project at Seattle University. Now, she told NBC News that vehicle residency is one of the fastest growing forms of homelessness. People of color are disproportionately represented among those living in their vehicles, as the pandemic highlights racial gaps in financial and housing security. For many who are experiencing homelessness, living in a vehicle is preferable to shelters because vehicles offer a greater degree of autonomy, privacy, and protection from the elements. Also, family and pets can stay together. In addition, the isolation of living in a vehicle has helped many people escape the worst of the coronavirus, as infection rates have been far lower than feared in the homeless population so far.
Unfortunately, many cities restrict or ban RVs or people sleeping overnight in their cars. Violations can prove devastating because parking tickets and towed vehicles can result in the loss of shelter and belongings.
So, in closing, the coronavirus pandemic is causing people to make hard choices. Jessica Pradu, a first-generation American from Mexico, said, "If you only have so much in savings, you can either spend that money on 3 months of rent or get a vehicle." And a lot of people are making those hard choices right now. Again, some of these stories, Julie, are so hard to read. Definitely one of them.
Teen trials come with unique complications. So far, vaccines in the United States have only been authorized for adults, with the youngest eligible being Pfizer's 16 years old. This means that younger teens are the logical next frontier for vaccine trials, as they contract COVID-19 at twice the rate of younger children.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, I reported that on COVID Noise Filter, that very, very seminal study that I think happened in South Korea, which was a really large study that showed just definitively that those that were in their teen years had the same rates of infection than those that were between the ages of 70 and 80. We didn't know that about teens.
Wow. Until then.
Really big deal of a study. So, but the teenagers are more difficult demographic to coordinate for clinical trials for obvious reasons. They're teens. And according to, and I remember being a teenager, it was a while back, but I remember being a teen. According to the New York
Times. You're like, I was there.
Yes. Hold on. Listen to this. You'll appreciate this. According to the New York Times, they can be difficult to recruit. I wonder, and have trouble with compliance. Compliance is important for the vaccine trials, which require participants to keep a symptom diary and attend regular appointments. We're talking about American teens here, y'all.
Like, I don't know. I'm just kind of hearing cha-ching, though, because that's $6,200 may be quite tempting to those 18-year-olds. And those 18 to 30 year olds, really, I mean, because come on now, do we really get ourselves together before 30? So, I mean, I don't know. Hey, you never know. But to recruit student participants, researchers involved in the trials have coordinated with schools and run social media campaigns. Some teens posted TikToks in vaccine research clinics, which spurred others to sign up.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. To enroll in a vaccine trial, minors give assent, but they must also get their parents' consent. Teens and parents have attended lengthy information sessions before enrolling. An objection by either party along the way terminates eligibility.
Yeah, these teen trials have the benefit of more information following the adult ones, because the adult trials didn't show difference by race. And researchers expect that the teen trials may be less diverse. Because the first trials were successful, a greater proportion of participants in the teen trial will receive the vaccine over a placebo than in the adult trial.
The earliest results of these vaccine trials are expected in the first quarter of the year. Approval for vaccinating teenagers is essential, as some research suggests that they are more efficient vectors of the virus, and the demographic will be key to making schools safer. You want teenagers? Hashtag cha-ching.
COVID-19 long haulers. Many patients have been developing what many are now calling long-term COVID, long COVID, or what I refer to as post-COVID syndrome. Studies have found that over 30% of mild COVID patients have symptoms up to 9 months after getting infected, according to CNN. Now, symptoms can range anywhere from fatigue to brain fog to heart and lung problems. Nurse Julia, this is so hard for me to wrap my head around.
Yeah. Some cities and countries are not opening clinics dedicated to those with long-term symptoms, but the demand is high. The patient list is long, and physicians and therapists are treating all ages, demographics, and health levels.
Yes, indeed. Health experts are worried about second health crises or a pandemic completely contributed by these long-term symptoms. Not only are they concerned for the health consequences involved, but long-term disability also impacts the economy negatively. Now, this is only worsened by not having specific treatment for COVID. Now, doctors and nurses are just left to treat the apparent symptoms. That's you and me, Nurse Julia.
Yeah, I hear you. Another group of people trying to make sense of these long-term symptoms are disability advocates, according to NPR. Yes. Advocates are trying to figure out if these patients are eligible for the disability benefits. They, along with lawmakers, are pressuring the Social Security Administration to update their policy. An attorney at the Disability Law Center in Massachusetts believes that this group of people are protected under the Americans with Disability Act, however.
I 100% agree with that. How's that even a question? Because even to qualify for disability benefits, three things are needed: a medical diagnosis, all right, easy peasy breezy, evidence that your abilities are affected, the whole globe knows that, okay?
Yeah.
And that the disability has to last for a while. Long COVID, post-COVID syndrome, long haulers all fit under that category.
That's it.
Now, the third reason is why it is unclear why COVID doesn't count, as it has barely existed for a year. But the disability I've seen, and I'm sure you've seen it too, Julia, has been really debilitating. And just even today, did you see the story about how when people smell is coming back, they're coming back, the neural pathways are coming back crossed over so that something that you would smell in the past, something that that we all would smell as one way,
sure,
after people who have lost their sense of smell are regaining their sense of smell, but the pathways are all completely different.
Oh, wow.
Which is crazy, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
hey, at the end of the day, many are dealing with symptoms for months, which affects their home and work lives. The Social Security Administration should focus and prioritize long haulers.
I 100% agree with you, Julia.
Me as well. You know, I'm just wondering what that criteria has to look like. I don't know if they're trying to weasel out of it, you know, find a loophole, but I argue that there's enough information right?
I'm so glad you went there, okay?
Yeah, like, I didn't want to call a spade, but let's do it. Like, I think there's enough long hauler info out there now, you know, and research to say that this is a thing.
100% agree with you. And yes, we're going to call a spade, and we're going to really call on the Social Security Administration to please, as Julia said, focus and prioritize long haulers.
Just as a reminder,